You're never going to make Village of the Year unless you have a first-class miniature town, you murder all the local riffraff, and you serve nothing but freshly roasted coffee. Unfortunately, the coffee you get from the supermarché could have been roasted months ago, which is why it's imperative to switch to Sparkplug coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that are always fair trade. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaffeinated. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this outstanding coffee to you in Canada or the US within 1 week of custom roasting it, so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug a la carte, or you can join the Autopilot Coffee Club for regular deliveries. It's completely flexible and customizable, and because you're a top 100 listener, Sparkplug is giving you 20% off your next coffee order if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100. So what are you waiting for? It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Shit just got real. Hi, peoples, and thank you from the city to the country and all points in between for devouring the 427th Ellis's Analysis on this channel called The Top 100 Project. We review movie classics and sometimes movie duds from years back, and we spoil all these ginger nuts. One of the greatest comedy lines of all time. We finally get to talk about it later on, though. I'm the rule-following fascist, in a crossword puzzle at least, who loves doing paperwork but has never fired two guns while leaping through the air and going, ah, Ryan Ellis. I will eventually, though. And here's the great police officer with a slew of commendations, the lady who's always thinking about the greater good.
The greater good.
My wife, Sergeant Beverly Ellis.
That's me.
By the way, that Point Break reference, it's good in Point Break. It's actually more applicable in this movie when Danny can't shoot his own dad. Firing the gun's pointless, but he's referencing a movie he loves.
Such a perfect callback because it's completely earned.
It makes more sense here than even in Point Break, yeah. Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Hot Fuzz, the follow-up from Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg and Nick Frost to one of the great comedy movies of all time, Shaun of the Dead. Cate Blanchett has a pretty great cameo in Hot Fuzz, but a man who directed her in another movie also has a tiny cameo in this one. Who?
Well, the Father Christmas who stabs Nick in the hand at the beginning of the film is Peter Jackson.
That's right. So he directed her in all three Lord of the Rings films and all three Hobbit films. Also, Saint Nick is stabbing a character named Nick, and the co-star in this movie was Nick Frost. I'm guessing Peter Jackson was cast partly because he was such a huge fan of Shaun of the Dead. He's one of the people that really talked it up. And he had such credibility at that point because it would have been coming out not long after they won Best Picture, Best Director, and all the rest of those Oscars for the third Lord of the Rings film. All right, after Funny Cops premiered in London 15 years ago in February 2007, it was released by a slew of production companies in March and April over here in that same year, of course, of 2007. It made $80 million worldwide, so it was pretty clearly a hit. But Bev, 15 years is a long time, so please remind everyone what this movie is about with the Hot Fuzz skinny.
Simon Pegg is Nicholas Angel, an overachieving London policeman officer who makes the rest of the force look bad, and so is reassigned to the quaint small town of Sanford,
Gloucestershire.
But Angel isn't bored for long. Bizarre accidental deaths keep adding up, making him think that there's something sinister going on in this seemingly perfect little village. With the help of his hapless new partner, Nick Frost's Danny Butterman, Angel uncovers a secret cabal of town elders so obsessed with winning the title of Village of the Year that they do away with the unseemly elements of the town with murder.
I do like your policeman officer reference to that. It's very good. One of the great touches is that Nick Frost, playing Danny in this movie, so often will parrot what Nick says, or Nicholas, had said before, because he learns from a better cop, and he knows it. He's not just aping him because he thinks he should, it's because he realizes that's the right terminology, including calling someone a police officer, or a traffic collision, not a traffic accident. Everyone calls them accidents, but then, as Nick says in this movie, that implies no one's at fault.
I remember learning that in driving school, that they don't use the term accident because they want us all to feel like we can prevent car accidents.
I said everybody, meaning regular people like us.
Yeah, but it's cops, a term that you could argue is both incorrect and not helpful because it diffuses responsibility when there's often people responsible for them.
Hmm. Or, in a nutshell, Sanford has a lot of cops for such a small town.
Yeah.
I don't know how many cops, something like 7 or 8. And there are not many people left when all is said and done, yet all of them except for Frank Butterman are still on the force. Who are they policing at that point? There's maybe 20 people left in this town, it seems.
A lot of people die in this movie.
Not really.
Including children.
Not that many. Okay, yes, the people that they murder, granted, but I thought you were going to say...
Yes, that's what
I thought you were going to lead to the main characters. Not the main characters, the older people who'd been in so many other big movies, who are cast as the village elders. They all seem to be alive at the very end, except, of course, for the doctor who gets exploded by that mine. Somehow everybody else in the police station lived, including Danny, who is shot in the process, does his, saving Nicholas from getting shot in that moment. But apart from the doc, I don't think any of those old murderers died in the shootout. Nicholas especially, but even Danny don't really ever really hit anybody, despite the fact there's so many bullets flying around.
The only villain that dies in an accident. He accidentally sets off the sea mine. But the NWA, the Neighborhood Watch Association, kill lots of people, including the teenagers that we meet at the beginning of the film who are drinking underage at the pub.
And the previous sergeant, Popwell, Nick's predecessor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the big bushy beard!
There he is. A corpse. The beard's still there. The rest of him's gone. Mostly, anyway. His bones. Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes number's on. Hot Fuzz. 91% of critics like this movie. 7.7 out of 10 was the average on the strength of 204 reviews. 89% of audiences also, so almost the exact same number. And there were similar numbers for Shaun of the Dead and Baby Driver, which is one of Edgar Wright's big films. The movie was number 101 at the box office in 2007. We covered Hairspray. That was 24th. We covered that quite a few years ago. Also, Chris and I just recently did Blades of Glory. That was 25th. And then you and I covered a long time ago No Country for Old Men, the Best Picture winner. That was 36th. No Oscar nominations of any kind for this movie. It got nominated for awards, but nothing in the major categories of SAGs or Golden Globes, if that's still considered. I don't think it is anymore because they're major, or Oscars. But I'm suggesting maybe editing, and possibly even the screenplay deserved a nomination. Okay, your last movie in the month of Bev. We've had five. This is easily the funniest one. Although, as I've said before, I never loved this movie as much as other people did because I was such a fan of Shaun of the Dead, and this felt like a bit of a step back. But it's not bad by any means, and I already said it has two of the greatest comedy lines ever in this one film. But your thoughts on your last movie of this month, Hot Fuzz.
So in my opinion, this is the best Edgar Wright film. I liked Shaun of the Dead, but I never loved it, never really got what all the fuss was about. And then I saw this, I get the whole Edgar Wright thing. But it must be about which films we grew up watching over and over again, because all the movies that it's parodying, well, not all of them, but a lot of them are movies that me and my sisters watched. Oh, we watched Point Break so many times, and maybe not Bad Boys, but Lethal Weapon and Die Hard, all the movies that are... Parody is the wrong word. Homaged. Almost in this film.
Many Tony Scott films, too, which
yes,
you didn't just
yeah,
mention.
They said they directly based the editing on Domino. Maybe this film just hits the right notes for me in a different way because I was never the biggest zombie film fanatic. But even on top of that, I feel like it's a perfect comedy. Outstanding script. Great performances. Good story. Truly, honestly funny. And most of all, it has Edgar Wright's incredible cinematic sensibility. There's just so much attention to detail, so much love put into every single frame of this film. It makes it special. It also makes it really rewatchable because it's so dense with jokes.
It's on Netflix, and it's a movie that I guess probably gets watched quite a bit. It's an easy... Well, it's 2 full hours, so it's pretty long. But it's an easy watch. Easy to throw and just go ahead and enjoy it. We own the Blu-ray, but we watched it on Netflix because why not? Streaming is easier for us to access than Blu-rays. Probably true for most people. I will discuss my two favorite moments in the film because they're both at the end. And who would have thought Timothy Dalton, of all people, would have both of them? He apparently had a lot of fun making this movie, and this is the Bond guy. Simon Pegg talked about how I'm doing a scene with Timothy Dalton as a helicopter flies overhead. That's appropriate, I guess, because a helicopter flies over the head at the end of this movie. And another Tony Scott type of shot, or maybe Michael Bay, actually, as it flies over their head in slow motion. But I'm going to keep talking. So anyway, he and Dalton are fighting. Pegg said, I'm fighting Bond. That's awesome. But Dalton has the two lines. I've been looking forward to quoting these forever. Stay back, or the ginger nut gets it.
You love it so much. Folks, he quotes this once a week is probably a modest estimation of how often I hear this line.
I'm not sure I'd ever heard the word ginger before in reference to a redhead. If I had, it wasn't common. Of course, it is now. I think also on South Park, Cartman called...
That was the first time I heard it was on South Park.
So maybe that was first. And then, of course, at the very end, when he falls onto the steeple in the model town, slipping on his own delivery truck. So it's the Sanford grocery store delivery truck that he slips on in the model town and falls on the steeple, which apparently was an actual death scene in, I think, a movie called No Escape they're referencing, where I guess the guy actually died. But in this movie, it goes through the meaty part of his jaw, so it doesn't actually hit
comes
anything.
Out
all
his
the...
mouth.
This really hurts.
Oh. It's the perfect delivery. It's whiny. It's like a happy kid or something. It's so funny.
But that's one of the reasons it's so funny, too, because it looks like he just died, but no, he's actually fine. And it looks like everybody did survive this massacre. And the only one that seems to have any regret at all about it is Rory McCann playing Michael Armstrong, Lurch, Yorp. And for those who don't recognize him, that is the Hound from Game of Thrones.
Oh, my God. You know, I knew that. And
Sandor Clegane.
I've forgotten it.
So anyway, you're a big fan of the movie. I like the movie quite a bit. It does have some huge laughs. There's some great references to so many things. Wright's so good about that. There's some good stuff early on. In the Blanchette scene, she's pretty funny in it, but that guy at the back, I guess it's supposed to be Joe Cornish, who's a filmmaking friend of Wright, who's made his own movies too. But anyway, somebody there says, well, me, about how she's dating somebody else in the, what are they even called? It's not the CSI in England, but...
A forensic team. Anyway,
there you go. Yeah. So that's a pretty funny scene. But the very beginning of the film shows the intensity of a guy who wasn't known for intensity. Simon Pegg wasn't that well known at this point, but he'd been in Mission Impossible 3 the year before. Of course, Shaun of the Dead before that. Probably other thing. Oh, Spaced, which we finally watched a year or so ago, the TV show. We'd never seen it until just recently. But he wasn't thought of as an action star. In this movie, he got in better shape, for one thing. But he's always running in this movie. There's an awful lot of action for him to do in this, so he had to get in better shape. And just things like that whole bike skid, the look on his face, the intensity, that's pretty funny, too.
He pulls it off.
Simon Pegg doing that, if it had been Tom Cruise, you expect that from Tom Cruise.
Yeah, but Simon Pegg, yeah, he wasn't a leading man action guy. It's like when Seth Rogen got fit. It's just something that you don't expect to see.
Mm-hmm. So Pegg and Frost have been teammates in some of these movies. Well, the Cornetto trilogy, which I've heard so many times before and only recently learned what the hell that even means. So
because it's just a British treat.
It's an ice cream treat.
Yeah.
So
we call them drumsticks here.
Oh, there you go. Okay, so in Shaun of the Dead, Simon Pegg buys one of those the day of the zombie apocalypse beginning. I think he takes it home and doesn't realize that the world's gone to shit. In this movie, the guys were eating their ice cream treat at one point, I guess. And it's also referenced in The World's End. So that's what the Cornetto thing refers to is the ice cream treat. And you've got Wright directing all three movies and writing them with Pegg.
And Nick Frost in all three.
Pegg is the star of all of them. Nick Frost is in all of them. And then some of the other actors are in smaller roles, too. We talked a minute ago about some of the cameos and whatnot, like Blanchette and Peter Jackson and Joe Cornish even. But Martin Freeman, Steve Coogan, and Bill Nye in the very beginning. Apparently it's Nye, not Nye. Martin Freeman in The Hobbit with Peter Jackson years after this, of course. He's the star of that. And so many other things he's done. Steve Coogan, who's done so many things over the years. He's the unbilled one. I guess he was just a bit of a surprise cameo. And then Bill Nye, who was so good in Shaun of the Dead as the dad. I ran it under a cold tap. His zombie bite. But they're the three cops in London who want to get rid of this actually competent cop. And then later on, of course, need him to come back. But he won't come back because he now has this great life in Sanford. And he gets to be the chief of the police in Sanford. So why would he go? But all these great
games. He has a friend. He has a life outside of police work because he made a friend in Danny.
A love interest. This is a movie like Chris and
it's
I recently covered.
Romance
Blades,
for sure.
Well, Blades of Glory, those two guys might as well be lovers rather than John Heder being off of Jenna Fisher. Didn't really buy that love story. Bought the two guys more so. Same with this movie, which I guess is also a parody of those kinds of films, because why don't Riggs and Murtaugh actually just do it? Because they might as well. One of the many chases in this movie is when Nicholas is chasing a kid in the grocery store and there are no charges placed. I'm assuming that's because they want to kill him. The NWA wants to kill him, so why would they charge him? And then we see the actors pulled over, the Romeo and Juliet actors, who apparently are doing an homage to the William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet movie from 1996 with the Love Fool thing, because that song is in that movie.
Oh, okay.
Love me, love me. And they're beheaded. This movie is also very gory, but in a cartoonish, silly way, so that maybe takes a lot of the sting off. But as I read online, people point this out, they're right to say it. If you took away the comedy and the silliness and the references and stuff, this could have been a deadly serious movie of its type. That would have fit in with those other ones. Now, Tony Scott and other people did have a lot of comedy in their films, but they didn't necessarily lean on comedy like this is supposed to lean on comedy. But the main story is, of course, all about violence. It's all about doing terrible things for the greater good.
The greater good.
Got to repeat it every time. And the people playing the village elders, almost all of them are, if not legends, pretty well-known English actors. We mentioned Dalton already. His Bond run is the biggest thing he ever did, and so funny in this movie. But Edward Woodward... He's the star in The Wicker Man, the original Wicker Man. And I guess he's known as an English action star from other things, too. Billy Whitelaw, who's the one fascist doing the crossword puzzle in the hotel. She's the crazy old lady in The Omen, the one who's protecting Damien.
Oh, it's all for you, right. Dan.
Well, she's not the one who hangs herself. Oh, okay. But she's protecting him as the... Well, she takes over from the woman who kills herself. That's what it is. And then Paul Freeman, he's in Raiders. He's Belloc, Indy's rival.
Okay.
Bev hasn't seen the movie in a long time, but we did cover that for the podcast.
Yes, Raiders.
Stuart Wilson, many movies in Lethal Weapon 3 and also Mask of Zorro. He's the villain in those two movies. But a very important cameo, I didn't realize how important it would be at the time, is Stephen Merchant as P.I. Staker.
Piss Staker, come on!
Great cut. Best known for The Office with Ricky Gervais. That was probably before this, but anyway, The English Office. And then also directed Nick Frost in a movie Chris and I covered last year, Fighting With My Family. And he's got a small role in this, but he always stands out because he's a goofy-looking dude, and he's so tall. And I did mention Jim Broadbent, who does play Frank Butterman, who's worked with everybody. You look at his resume, he's one of those actors that seems to have worked with every single major director in some role, sometimes more than once. Harry Potter included in that, and then Chris and I covered him last year for scoring at the movies also, and then Damned United. I don't think you and I have covered him very often before, if not ever before, maybe never.
I don't think so.
But he's a pretty big role. We already said one of the great comedy payoffs, which is, I can't shoot my own dad, bang, 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 in the air. And since I'm talking about the cast, I'll mention three other major actors in this. Patty Considine and Rafe Spall are the two Andys. Considine was in The World's End, and Spall had been in Shaun of the Dead. And then Olivia Colman, who's also pretty funny in this. She's cute.
She's so funny.
And she's become as big a star as anybody in this entire movie. Won the Oscar a few years ago for, forget the name of the movie, The Favorite.
Probably going to be nominated again this year.
For The Lost Daughter, which you and I saw. We recommend that
and
film.
And she's wonderful in that
strong
movie.
Performance. I just happened to see her. I didn't even know she was in this movie. Confetti on Disney Plus. So it's an English film. Martin Freeman's in that too. She plays a nudist.
You see her full frontal?
I believe full frontal, but definitely the boobs constantly. And I felt a little weird because even though Coleman is only a few weeks older than I am, she was born in 1974 also, she feels more like a motherly person. I don't want to insult her because she's basically my age. Well, she is my age. But it felt a little weird watching Olivia Colman be nude. But she's so cute in this,
too. That's the point of nudism, though, that it's not sexual, that it doesn't matter who you are.
No, I know, but still. Anyway, I just wanted to mention that because I happened to see that around the same time we watched Hot Fuzz, and I didn't know she was even in it. I certainly didn't know the role she had. But all those actors, we already talked about Blanchett and her small little cameo, who stood out the most to you in this movie? Because that would be saying something about who your favorite character is or who stood out the most.
Timothy Dalton. It's not just the great jokes at the end. Every scene he's in, he steals. He has that car salesman smile. I can't remember if this is the first time we meet him that he just jogs up next to Simon Pegg and is like, arrest me, I'm a slasher. A slasher of prices. Like,
and he's a slasher.
Says the word supermarché. He's so committed to the part, and it's so surprising to see him. He's just this paragon of class.
Well, because the movie sets up it's one person, it seems so obvious he'll be at least one of the killers, if not the only killer. He's just one of many. And that whole thing where they're wearing robes is one of the reasons they get away with that. Even Michael Armstrong, Lurch, Yorp, is wearing one when he comes to kill Angel. But then Angel managed to beat him with his peace lily. I was looking online. There's so many great things online. I didn't know this at all, so I'm glad people wrote this. That apparently, I think Japanese, but a peace lily. I got to take care of my plant. All the times he talks about that. You don't have to do almost anything to take care of these plants. It's like a cactus. You barely ever water it. Just leave it alone. It'll do its own thing. Dalton is great as the villain, and he's so funny. It would have been interesting to see him just playing a straight villain, though, because I think he could have done that, too. If he just played a villain of pure menace in an absolute drama with this storyline, he would have pulled it off just as well. But then who knew he could be so funny?
So funny. So we're talking about the script and the story, and I think one of the things that makes this movie stand out is it has a really outstanding story. They worked for a really long time on the script, close to a year. Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg wrote it together. And it has this airtight story with lots of callbacks, lots of references to movies, lots of little throwaway lines that have amazing payoffs later. A great one I think of is when somebody's bragging about being an extra in Straw Dogs, and then that same person gets killed by a bear trap.
Mm-hmm.
Little things that you don't even notice until you watch the film 3-4 times and you put it together. And that's just the first way that Edgar Wright makes these comedies that stand out. It's not just that they stand out because he is very creative and innovative and deserves tons of credit for that, but also for just never, ever phoning a single thing in. He pays so much attention to detail, and there is not a scene that he doesn't do something to make it funnier. Even if the performances are funny and the jokes are funny in the script, he will still use something cinematic to punch it. Whether it's in the camera or the way he uses sound effects. You know, you talked about how you think that editing, it deserved an Oscar nomination for editing. The sound design in this movie, Oh my god, it is so brilliant. The way he uses sound effects that are completely unrelated to the point he's trying to punctuate, and he does this in all of his films, and it makes all of his films so punchy and fun, entertaining, and just skillfully done. So many comedies these days... We say this often when we talk about comedies, and we'll start talking about the technicals, be it the cinematography or the editing, whatever. We rarely have very much to say.
Editing has to be important.
Editing
for a comedy.
Is always important, it's true, because pacing is such a big part of it. But even movies that we would easily say have really sloppy stories, even if they have emotional payoff, something like Bridesmaids, I'm thinking of. Great emotional payoff, great story, but sloppily told in the sense that there are scenes that slow it down, that don't belong, that mess with the tone, they should have been cut. Individual scenes are really funny, but as a whole, the story doesn't have the same flow as something like this. But even more than that, all the jokes rely on the screenplay and the actors, and of course improv, which I think is almost the driving style of comedy right now, at least in Hollywood comedy films. You look at everything that Judd Apatow ever touches, and it's heavily improv, which is great in some senses. You get this really specific kind of performance out of that, and there's, of course, been so many amazing comedic moments that have come from these brilliant actors, but surrounding all that improv is some almost TV-level, basic-ass camera work, nothing special, really simple setups. They're just letting everything revolve around the actors.
Not well-paced, necessarily.
Not necessarily well-paced.
Not that creative when it comes to how they made the movie.
Yeah, not that creative. Look at the scene we were talking about earlier where we're trying to establish character and place. And so you have Nick Angel, this fish out of water in a small town, and he's a total killjoy. So how do we show that? Well, he's going to kick these underage drinkers out of a bar. How many lesser films would just shoot it straight, let the actors do their thing and make it as funny as they can, but really not go out of their way to do anything cinematic to punch up the scene? But you look at the scene and the way it took place, there's these special lighting cues, there's tons of audio, there's really fast whip cuts and pans, and it turns into this cinematically also incredibly interesting and punchy scene that gives it so much extra value. And that is Edgar Wright in a nutshell. That's how he approaches every single film he makes. I think it works better in comedy. Baby Driver is a film that I respected, especially technically. I think technically it might be his best film. All the car chase scenes are out of this world. Yeah. The action stuff in that movie is incredible. But there was just something empty and lacking, which is funny because this movie, Shaun of the Dead, these are movies that have tons of warmth. The character development is so beautiful and such a big part of what carries the movie through. It didn't need it, but it had it, and that's what makes it from good to great.
We haven't seen his two movies last year yet, although one of them is now on Netflix, The Sparks Brothers, a documentary about the Sparks Brothers, and then also Last Night in Soho, which I don't think is a comedy either.
No, it's a horror, I think.
So he has every right in the world to branch out and do other things, but he is obviously best at comedy, and as we just said, also a very technical director. So Baby Driver I only saw one time. I will watch it again one day, but I think you're right. That's missing some comedy in there. Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which is a cult movie, not that popular at the time. A lot of great actors in smaller roles than that, including Chris Evans.
It's a funny movie, too, but not as rat-a-tat constant comedy as the Coronado trilogy.
I'm like having Olivia Colman in this movie in a fairly important supporting role. Maybe the biggest name at this point, at least when it comes to award success the last several years in a smaller role, though. But Chris Evans, before he was really all that well-known, certainly before he was Captain America, is in Scott Pilgrim. Around the same time, maybe, as he did Captain America. Now, Chris Evans could open a movie, probably, but he couldn't at that point. Wright definitely is in his ballpark when he is doing comedy. And he always writes his own films, too. He's one of those auteur-type directors who writes, not once in a while, he always writes his own movies, and a lot of the time with Peg, these Cornetto movies especially.
I think he's incredible, but I don't think he's made that many incredible films.
No, I agree with that. I like him an awful lot, but past Shaun and past this one, I don't think we own any of them. And I know that doesn't mean ever as much as it used to because you can watch stuff on streaming, but that's still a marker for me because if I'm going to spend money on a movie, I want to make sure it's on my shelf. I don't have to worry about Netflix or Disney Plus or Prime taking it away. And it says a lot because I wasn't a huge Pilgrim fan. Baby Driver, only saw it one time, like I said, and I haven't yet seen some of his more recent stuff.
Scott Pilgrim and Baby Driver are films that dazzled me, but I just didn't feel the need to come back and watch over and over again. They're visually outstanding, but stories I'm just not... I don't know, just don't care about.
What about The World's End?
Yeah, that one just fell apart, especially in the third act, but it really never caught me.
You know what
it is?
They pulled a South Park. South Park, some of the best episodes ever. The big reveal at the end is...
Crab people. That one always...
It's not a human being. Yeah. I forget the episode exactly, but it was a two-parter. And the end of the first part is Cartman and I believe Kyle are on big wheels. And again, sound effects that are on these little plastic toy things, and you hear this type sound effects. And I remember that being so funny, but then the end of the episode, the two-parter, is, yeah, grumpy people. It's lame. You guys are better than that.
It's a bit of a cop-out.
And The World's End does the same thing. It ends up being that there's aliens inside of people's bodies.
Thematically, I can see how it has more intent than Crab People, where they weren't just like, oh shit, how do we end this movie? Pretty good through line through the film about being replaced with your younger self and contemplating aging. It just doesn't work as well as the first two films. You know what do they say? You have your whole life to make your first movie. Maybe he used up all of his best ideas in his first two films and hasn't really hit the nail on the head ever again. Although people would certainly disagree. I think there's lots of people who adore Scott Pilgrim. Mm-hmm. Baby Driver, I don't know if it has as many devout
fans. It has
fans.
A lot, though.
The action scenes in Baby Driver, I can't praise them enough. They are some of the best action that Hollywood has seen.
One of the biggest things about Wright, though, he is one of the regular, well, not regular, I guess, but he's been on Doug Loves Movies podcast several times as a guest. He's a big enough name that he could say, I'm too busy for that, Doug. But he goes on there because he knows his movie trivia. I think he's friends with Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez and some of those guys who are big movie holics, and Kevin Smith also. I think they're all buddies. And he really knows his movie trivia, so that's why he still goes on the show. He was on not that long ago because so much of the conversation was about Last Night in Soho, and especially the Sparks Brothers that day. He also is a big part of that movie collection that Danny has. A gigantic collection for a guy who doesn't seem like he makes that much money and lives in the middle of nowhere. I don't know when he bought all the movies. I guess he went to London, I guess, the nearest town, and
that rent is pretty cheap.
30 or 40 at a time. But that movie collection we see in that room is Edgar Wright's, apparently Joe Cornish as well, part of his collection, and then someone else. But I could have believed, if someone had said that was all Edgar Wright movies, I could believe that.
Your movie collection could rival
our.
Our? I give you to the marriage with like 80 DVDs versus your 1,000.
I think Edgar Wright has more than that, though. So he's such a movie fan. He's such a likable guy on those podcasts. That's part of the reason why I want to see his movies. I definitely will watch Last Night in Soho. If I don't like it, then I don't like it. But I would not miss one of his films. And had it been a normal year last year, and now this year, and the year before, we probably would have seen that in the theater because he's worth our money. He's a good dude, and makes
he's
fun movies.
Yeah, one of
movies.
Those directors I don't miss in the theater, even if I feel like I'm dumping on him now. It's funny how I really think he's one of the best directors working.
But you don't his actually like his
style,
final product that much.
Yes, his style is so outstanding. I was thinking earlier today about how I feel kind of the same about Denis Villeneuve, where I love his movies, but I don't ever want to watch them again. I have no desire to go back and revisit them. I find the technique dazzling and incredible. Not just innovative, because that's one thing, but it's innovative and it's artful and thoughtful and appropriate. So these are two directors who I respect so much and I think are doing incredible things for film, but I don't know that I adore their movies exactly, but I won't miss them.
You wouldn't miss seeing them, you mean? Yeah.
I wouldn't miss them in the theater. Yeah, well, yeah. Especially Denis Villeneuve movie, but we'll probably see Last Night in Soho at home simply because
we'll have to now.
It's
long gone from the theaters.
Yeah.
Okay, so one of the running themes in this movie, a couple running themes, a lot of running themes, I guess, but one of the big ones is that swan that P.I. Staker is looking for, and he is on screen at the very end, Stephen Merchant, with his swan. Also, a character's name, Merchant. But if you think about it, the swan ends up being a very key character because Broadbent and Dalton driving away, they maybe would have gotten away, except the swan's in the way, and then they crash into the model town thing, and that's what starts the fight between Peg and Dalton with the ginger nut thing at the end. The other runner I like so much is the can off the head, the random, I don't know how that even would work from those angles, but the trash can off the head, and at the end, Nicholas enjoys it. He hadn't before, but he does at that point. So that's another thing Wright is so good about, is finding a runner that's sometimes bizarre and weird, like a trash can off the head, and making it funny. But then that swan actually paying off is a very important plot element.
There's so much setup and payoff. The whole meeting of Danny and the beginning of their friendship. Nick is very reluctant to become friends with Danny, but he's peppering him with questions, very guileless, innocently asking him if his real life in London as a cop is anything like all these action movies that he's seen. And he names one thing after another. Do you shoot your gun in the air? And you'll, oh.
Which
of
all of them that he says do come true.
Exactly. But
or at least one of the two of them do it. Maybe not necessarily
yes,
Nicholas.
Yes. It's never in this really ostentatious way that's calling super duper attention to it. And it would be really easy when you're watching the film for the first time to not even put that together. Although, if you watch Point Break a million times when you were a kid, like I did, you definitely see it the first time. And that's part of the pleasure of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Not being able to shoot his own father and shooting his gun in the air, screaming, ah. The movie they do watch along with Point Break that night, though, is one I hate. I've never seen a second time and will never watch again. And the reason I didn't watch Bad Boys for Life, which is free on Prime, I could watch it, but I'm not going to. Bad Boys 2, hated it, fucked that movie, now watching it again. But that is the movie that has the shit just got real. Which is said in this film, too.
I love the touch that it's always Bad Boys 2. And he's like, you've never seen Bad Boys 2? Not Bad Boys. But Bad Boys 2 is that he's really hung up on it. Because he doesn't have good taste, necessarily. He just likes all action movies.
Yeah. Well, he brings those two DVDs out and says, which one are we going to watch first?
Yeah.
Not which one are we going to watch. Well, they do fall asleep during Bad Boys 2, I think. They actually watch Point Break. One of the people victimized in this movie is the journalist. And this was almost a nutshell. I can't abide murder, but a journalist who's a terrible speller, killing him, that I understand. And he's a terrible speller.
He said I was 55, but I'm 53!
But that is a gruesome death.
I know. That's really gory, too.
And they're also lucky that he happened to be in exactly the right spot, because he could be where he's supposed to be, but he could be a foot off, and it wouldn't have killed him. Well, it maybe would have grazed him enough to actually kill him, but falling square in his head, that steeple thing, whatever you want to call it. Hey, I guess in a way it's kind of what happens to Simon Skinner.
He also gets taken out by a steeple.
But underneath.
Miniature one going through his jaw. Yeah.
Right. Leslie Taylor is sheared to death. That's a gruesome murder.
After Shaun of the Dead, it's not really that gory, is it? That's one of the things that turned me off about Shaun of the Dead a little bit, is that the horror is too horrific. And it actually does get quite serious in the last act and goes from a comedy to a proper horror movie, and the tone shift never jived with me.
To make the plot pay off, because they had no choice but to do that. Well, in this movie, the middle section does that, because the shootout stuff, there's a lot of dead serious things that they're doing, but it's played for comedy, especially at the very end with the four guys and the model town. But the middle section is when a lot of plot elements are taking over and Nicholas is starting to piece together what's really going on here. When the elders are having their cult meeting, that's, of course, when we and Nicholas find out what's really going on. They're all in on it. But, of course, the big twist in that scene is not even so much that they're all in on it, because you might have thought, oh, I would have guessed that, but that Frank is, too, because it's pretty well hidden before that that he's in any way a bad guy. He's a cop. Seems like he's a pretty good cop. He's part of the comedy.
And it's Danny's dad!
How could you? But Danny's mother, Irene, being killed, I guess, put him over the edge. Frank, that is. Now, another payoff, of course, too, is the Danny thing. It's so out of nowhere in the pub where he does the fork to the eye and then he's squirting out the ketchup as if it's blood, but then it ends up saving Nicholas's life because he pretends that he stabs him. Danny does. But he actually just stabbed a ketchup packet to get Nick out of town. And what brings Nick back is seeing DVDs in a rest stop. He was going back to London, but he sees the DVDs and thinks, no, I gotta go back and fix this and also help Danny because he likes him. And he loves him.
He's forged a friendship.
And the payoff of that, of course, is when Danny dives in front of the shot that the doctor's taking and takes the bullet and somehow survives. When that mine goes off and there's nothing left of the building, it's all rubble, somehow Danny's still alive. I guess because it's a comedy, you get away with this. And a lot of movies have done this anyway. The more serious action movies have done it as well. But it is pretty absurd that not only did Danny survive, but any of them survived that explosion.
Another Game of Thrones. The guy who owned the mine is Walder Frey.
Walder Frey. Yeah, David Bradley. So you got a few major players from... Well, he wasn't a major player, but one of the more memorable ones in a smaller role in Game of Thrones.
So like we've said, this is a parody of an action film, and his first two films were parodies of genres of film. And his parodies only work because they're not really parodies so much as homages. And his TV series, Spaced, which is lovely. If you like this movie, and if you like Shaun of the Dead, do yourself a favor and go watch Spaced. I think it's 12 episodes in total. It's the traditional BBC
series. We didn't want it to be over. We really enjoyed it. Jessica Stevenson, I think is her name. She was in Shaun of the Dead, but she's not in anything else that these guys made. I hope it wasn't a falling out, because she and Peg on that show have such chemistry.
Such heart. Just delightful show that will give you faith in the world. So there's so much love for film in Spaced and in Shaun of the Dead and this, and love for action movies poured into it. Sometimes parodies will fail because they are making fun of what they're trying to satire. I think if you're trying to approach something with superiority, it's always going to seem cold. You might get some good jokes in, but if you're punching down on something, it's never going to have the same impact as when you're approaching it with true affection, which is definitely the case here.
You say affection, but one of the things that works so well in this movie, and it's also true about Shaun of the Dead, is the two guys, I mentioned chemistry. Well, Peg and Frost have great chemistry too. And Nick Frost in this movie, because he's so funny in Shaun of the Dead, but he's also a dick. And you can see why Pete doesn't like him. He shouldn't like him in their pre-zombie lives. But in this film, he is adorable. And it is pretty awesome the way that he's repeating proper phrases, including saying not policeman or policeman officer, but a police officer, to be gender neutral. Even back then, people were realizing that's how you should refer to people. But I really love Frost in this movie. I think he actually steals it.
Oh, I totally agree.
And Peg is great in the lead role, so that's saying a lot.
Yeah. He has one of the greatest intros because he arrests him for drunk driving, yeah. takes him to the station.
But he's a cop.
But then the next morning, discovers he's a cop. Their relationship is so sweet, so lovely. And it really is all about his complete guileless, almost devotion. He must be wanting not just the excitement that Angel brings. It would be very easy to hate Nick Angel because he is a merciless killjoy.
He's a fascist.
He's a bit of a fascist, but we have this dopey galoot who just looks up to him and thinks he's wonderful and loves the rules, wants to do things right, loves that there's somebody around who knows what the rules are and can spell it all out for him and patiently teach him. What's the joke? Actually, everybody loves a pedant. Actually, there is a value to somebody being around who is going to be the sergeant. My sister, my beloved sister, one of my favorite people in the whole wide world, and she would admit this, is a total Nick Angel who is very hung up on rules.
Even more than me.
Playing a board game with her, let me tell you.
Oh, yes. Or a trivia game.
You gotta be paying attention. She will not let you get away with treating it like it's supposed to be for fun.
We will have fun and we will have order.
Yes.
At the same time.
You'll follow the rules and you all like it. Like, she's literally not allowed to play Monopoly anymore. She won't let herself play Monopoly
Neither are you.
Anymore. For different reasons.
We played it once.
It's not for what you think. I wasn't being a jerk. I'm just very fast. I just played it a lot.
The dice haven't finished moving. You're telling me what I'm going to do in the next play. Like, I'm the one rolling the dice.
You get seven. It's like, Marvin Gardens, $24, please.
Wow, can I let the die?
No! But I think it's what makes his character... They make each other lovable in that sense. You don't get that dichotomy in Shaun of the Dead. In Shaun of the Dead, they're both kind of loafs. The Nick Frost character is bringing the worst out in him, and that's what he has to fight against. And then they have the other roommate who's the good guy who does everything right. But he's
Pete.
He's kind of a bad guy, right?
He's got his shit together, and they don't.
Yeah.
But he's the asshole, and he's the one who, well, then again, so does Nick Frost, but he's the one that dies early in the story.
But in Hot Fuzz, you have the opposite ends of the spectrum, yeah. and the fact that they complement each other, and they totally make each other better... In a believable way. It's a very earned relationship that they
it's
get.
It's not believable that Danny survived that gunshot and then the explosion.
But he's wearing his regulation bulletproof vest just like he's supposed to because
when they were doing
Nick
paperwork,
Angel would make him.
When they're doing paperwork?
Well, how else did he survive it?
Well, they shouldn't have survived the explosion either, so as I've said three times now. Them doing paperwork, I guess, is an homage to Wright and Peg doing the research with real cops and saying that no movie ever really seems to get that right, that so much of a cop's life is doing paperwork. When you hear, say, and I just watched this last night again, Lethal Weapon 2, Mel Gibson tell the story about what happened when his wife died. He was swamped in paperwork and forgot about a dinner date, and then the wife died in a car accident that he should have been part of or maybe would have prevented if he was driving. And there's a whole other angle on that, and that's not the point. The point being that he was up to his eyes in work. Well, I think what he means is paperwork, because that's so much of what a cop has to do. We see it several times in this film, including with them all doing it at the very end. So, of course, Wright and Peg wrote this, Wright directing. The producers, Tim Bevan, and Eric Fellner, who worked a lot with the Coens. I believe they're the Working Title guys. That's the name of their production company, but a lot of Coen credits for them. And then Neera Park, who produced Shaun of the Dead, and then last year's Last Night in Soho. The movie is 2-3-5-1. We watch it on Netflix. Cinematographer Jess Hall has not worked with Wright again since this movie. Did shoot The Spectacular Now, though. The Cutter. Major credit, we already talked about how this movie, despite being 2 full hours, has a pretty great pace. Chris Dickens also cut Slumdog Millionaire the year after this, the Best Picture winner. And then Paul, another movie I haven't seen a second time, but probably should, a comedy with Peg and Frost, but not by Edgar Wright.
I will say a note about the editing. All these intricately edited scenes, a tapestry of different visual effects, really fast cuts, sound effects. This kind of editing is really hard, and it takes forever.
Well, a few frames of a cut, too. They do it in probably all the Coronado movies, maybe every single Wright movie, but I can definitely picture Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz doing it multiple times. And sometimes for a laugh, when you see the merchant guy go home, pissed drunk, and then they kill him, pretending that he killed himself, the elders kill him. But it's cross-cut with Peg and Frost watching movies and drinking beer and getting drunk and all that kind of stuff. And there are a lot of edits in a short period of time to make a joke. So it's well worth the effort, but it is a lot of effort. So Dickens and Wright, credit to them. The composer David Arnold did the music on Independence Day and many other Roland Emmerich films, and also has worked a lot of times on Bond films, which is appropriate because of the connection with Timothy Dalton. The music doesn't really stand out, but it is definitely an homage slash parody to Tony Scott type action films. As for what happens next, well, Sanford probably loses the Village of the Year award. Although the voting is probably close.
The judges are there for the massacre.
I guess that's Wright and Peg's parents and then somebody else's parent well playing those characters. They don't really dialogue. They're barely on screen. But during the chaos, all the bullets everywhere, these guys doing all this stuff, you just watch them standing around checking off boxes. So I guess they didn't win the award. And they might never win it again, but at least Sanford has a nice bit of jovial tyranny going on in the police department. Because after all, Nicholas Angel, despite the fact he's often right, is a bit of a fascist, like Billy Whitelaw said about him the first time she met him. Okay, well then, your final film in this month, and one of the funnier ones we will probably cover for a long time to come. Last thoughts on Hot Fuzz.
It's a true movie lover's movie. Edgar Wright's never been better. It's just an instant mood booster. It's gotta cheer you up.
It's an almost terrific parody. Well, it's a good parody, but it's almost a terrific movie. It's not quite terrific, but it's close. Of these buddy cop films. But it is exciting in its own right. Just its own story is exciting and dramatic and whatnot. Some great action scenes. And it has one of the funniest endings ever. In many ways, because of course the Dalton stuff, but Peg being a part of that, the Futtermans, their payoff, and the tragedy too, with the mother apparently killing herself.
Because they didn't win Village of the Years, and that's the rub?
I meant to ask you why exactly that happened again, but that's something that's revealed, isn't it? When we find out in the town elder meeting, the cult meeting.
Don't they say that she was so upset that she drove off a cliff and it's not necessarily implied she killed herself? It may have been an accident. She was just so distressed.
That's pretty dark, too. Maybe it's another homage then to Lethal Weapon 2, because that's supposed to what happened to Riggs's wife.
And there always has to be a dead mother or a dead wife for a hero in their origin story.
Yeah. Okay, Hot Fuzz in the books. In 7 days, it will be February, and we're going to begin the month of Strangelove. Not the movie, although we love Dr. Strangelove. All 4 February flicks will be about untypical romance and or lust. And first up will be a look at Maggie Gyllenhaal and James Spader up to their ears in some hot BDSM in Secretary. The coming attraction's opinion question. Thinking in a BDSM way. This is an unusual question, I know. Would you rather spank people? Be spanked? Watch people spank others, or would you rather just be a cutter?
Oh my gosh.
Which is what she was before the spanking begins.
Thanks for that, Ryan. So for the answer to that question, tune in next week for our podcast about Secretary. For more from us, you can visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project wherever you listen. We have hundreds of episodes that are all available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made. In exchange for all of this content, perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review. We're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. You can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT. It's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. It's not case sensitive, and that will get you a 20% discount. Can you end the podcast?
I don't think I know how.
And cut.
Stay back, or the red Logitech mouse gets it. Click.